This is part two of the oral history interview with Margaret Kett Ziegart. It was recorded in two segments on May 8th and June 20th, 2017. You will hear the June 20th segment first, as it revisits a portion of the interview lost due to technical errors. Topics covered in this segment include much of Kett's early art career in New York. It is followed by the May 8th segment, which details Kett's life in both the Bay Area and Mill Valley as a teacher, artist, and mother.
It is June the 20th, and I'm here with Kett Ziegart.
Hi, Kett. These aren't in sequence, but I'm going to say a little bit about my schooling, which began at East Lansing High School and Central School, and it was formerly the only school in East Lansing, so there were desks that were very high that we went to for assemblies that had been for the high school age people. And the other thing that I especially remember was a chute, which was a fire escape that was a great big chute, and it was much fun to go down, and the playground had teeter totters. As far as education goes, there were four of us that were in the class that were one right after the other, all the way through alphabetically seated, that had our work done early, so we were often out of class. After we'd help the teacher, then we'd go help the principal. And then that was sort of given us free time. So it was a pleasant experience. The only sad thing was in kindergarten, a little boy was killed. So after he was killed, they started having safety patrols. I never was a safety patrol person, but I was always glad to see them. Then we went on to junior high school. And that was 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. And this was East Lansing Junior High School. And then the high school was in the same building. And we had assemblies, and we had a balcony. And that was the first time I'd ever sat in the balcony. And I've sat in many balconies since, because they're in the price range. But for the 6th graders, that was where we were sat. Then we had outstanding teachers in high school. And at our 55th high school reunion, I only had gone to the 50th. And at our 55th, we talked about our favorite teachers. And every one of us said Miss Hawks was our favorite teacher. And not only that, most of us said she was the best English teacher we'd ever had, including college, because she taught us grammar. She taught us ways to use references. And she expected us to do as much as we could possibly do. And I must have been a very precocious, unsufferable person, because I remember reading the Rig Veda, and that was the thing that I wrote as my junior high school report on in 7th grade. And I'd gone over to the college library and used footnotes from our Encyclopedia Britannica. We didn't ever buy any new books, because this was during the Depression years, but we always used the library. And we had the Encyclopedia Britannica new book that came out each year. Our library was really a marvelous place for me, because we had a fabulous librarian. It was a small library, and the children's section I went through, and then I went through the junior high school section, and then we had this librarian who helped me go through the other sections. And there was one book I never read that was always on my mother's shelf, and I don't recall her reading it either, but it was called Anthony Adverse. And I want to read and see what Anthony Adverse was about, because now when people say there's a negative impact on some element of planning, I keep thinking it's not negative, because negative means it's positive. It's Anthony Adverse's word, adverse. And almost everyone does not say that, except the documentation does use the word adverse. Then I went easily transition into Michigan State, which was in the same town, East Lansing, but I lived in a dormitory, so I didn't live at home. And the dormitory had been an Air Force two wings, Mason and Abbott, and used for housing for the Air Force that was located there. Huh. And this was the year as they were Downing troop size. And so our wing, Mason, was used for girls. And we went off, and you know how young girls go off to college. Well, we went off to college to a room that had triple duck beds and two bureaus and no closet. So many of us had a great time. We had a very strong person who was the, she was, I think, I can't recall what you called her, but she was sort of overlooking all of us
like
on our floor.
Like the house mother, maybe, or?
Well, it was not
counselor,
a house mother. No, it wasn't either of those, but whatever it was, Ruth Meinke was a really long-term friend, and later she came back to East Lansing and sold real estate and became a good friend of my mother's. One of the things that was familiar to me was Tower Guard, which was an honorary for underclassmen at the school, because my mother had teas for different organizations, and this was because my father had this fabulous backyard. It was really, really nice, and we had a bent grass front yard. Perhaps I told you about the bent grass, but one of the people that was of the four that I sat with in order was Burton Edelson, and at their 55th reunion, he came up to me. He said, "You know, I'll never forget." And I thought, "Oh, what wonderful thing won't he forget? Your father's front yard," because it had a front yard of bent grass with no weeds. Because one of the things that we did was hand weed out all the weeds, and sometimes there were four-leaf clover because it was a small patch that had four-leaf clover. So every once in a while, there was that pleasure about weeding, and it was very organized. You put strips up. But the backyard had a very natural landscaping, and my father, as I probably mentioned, had four sisters who were artists and one that was a doctor. But he had a strong sense of nature and artistic design, which actually one of my sons had inherited. But the thing about high school and going into college was I was familiar with the campus, and it was ranked as one of the most beautiful campuses at the time. Lovely landscaping, and it had a tower and chimes in the carillon that played music. And I was reminded about my time in high school because just recently there was a meeting at the lodge in Marin County, and for people who had gone to Michigan State, and the alumni, there were maybe seven of us there, and then the two women who were from Michigan State, and we had a very nice conversation, and we remembered things about the campus. The schooling that I had was most unusual at the time for a state college, we called them then, from Chicago. University of Chicago had a new program called Basic Skills, I think it was, that we adopted. And by having the basic skills, you could read a textbook, and if you could pass the exam with a very high score, then you didn't have to take the other terms. You had to take one term, but maybe not the other two, because we were on a term basis. So by doing that, I was able to graduate after three years of three terms and one summer school. And I was going to be in the class of 1948 because I entered in 44, but I actually was in 1947. And this past weekend, or last past week rather, my fifth grade, grandson had a graduation ceremony, and I recall that I had never been in a graduation ceremony except at high school. So my high school years terminated with pleasure. I was very, very busy. You had a yearbook called the Cinead, and I looked at it the other day, and I was in almost every kind of an organization. However, I was very active my freshman year in the church, which was across and helped cross the street from the campus. And there were It was actually a WASP town by law, which I had never known about. But there were Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptists, and Congregationalists that, with the college, built this large, very nice church with a wonderful organ in it. And for 25 years, no other church could be in the town. And at that time, there were no black people, and my mother used to say, I really probably shouldn't say this, but it made me always angry. Well, some of the Jewish people are my very best friends, because she was in many organizations, and they were in the organizations that she had been on different boards. And so one of the things, by freshman year, I sat down and realized I didn't have any time at all. So I charted out the hours, and I was not in the sorority at that time, but I spent 20 hours at the church each week. So I just stopped going to church, just cut it out altogether. Stopped teaching Sunday school and all these things I was doing, and became very active on campus. And very active, I started off in the home ec department. But the people that I really knew were in the arts department. The thing that I liked about the home ec program was the draping and fashion design and color, things like that. But then we had to do something with nutrition. And the nutrition class, the first thing we did was work with given a rat. And so at that point, I decided I wanted to change. And I went into the art department. And that was not particularly pleasing to my parents, because they had both been working with young people, giving them opportunities in extension work throughout Michigan, and other friends were in the department. My mother was an extension person, and they were based in the home ec department, and my father working primarily originally in agriculture extension, and then when he was still in northern Michigan, he became involved with the 4-H Club and was a 4-H Club lead state leader. And in high school, perhaps even in junior high school, every other year I would go to Washington, D.C. with my parents and the outstanding 4-H Club boy and outstanding 4-H Club girl. So I was familiar with art museums from there, and then our exceptionally fine art teacher that we had, who later went on to teach in universities, who took us to art museums. And she took us to the Toledo Art Museum and the Detroit Art Museum. Recently, I found out that I had actually been in two different exhibits from college artwork at the Detroit Art Museum. So I really am involved and really liked art. And the artists had very good discussions, and we spent a lot of time discussing things over tables, as I think most young people do that are interested in ideas. Having graduated early because of my experience at Cranbrook Art Academy, which was phenomenal, my basic teacher there was a man from the Bauhaus. He'd been teaching at the Bauhaus. And the reason I was able, my family actually paid for this, going to the Cranbrook Art Academy, although this was the tail end of the Depression. They paid for this because it was a Finnish, Eliel Saarinen was the director and had designed the campus. And his name was Youngworth, did sculpture there. And he was Swedish, and my mother was Swedish. And so this fit primarily because one of their friend's daughters had been there, and Eames had just finished his time there.
This is Eames, the furniture?
Yes, he just had finished
designer.
His time there. Mm-hmm. And Robert Saylors, I remember, was a weaver, and Maya Grothjohn was a superb ceramist. So this was an opportunity to be around professional people.
Where was Cranbrook?
Cranbrook is by Bloomfield Hills, which is near Detroit, Michigan.
Detroit, okay.
It's north of Detroit.
And when was it that you went to that academy?
I went between my sophomore and junior year. My year between high school and college in the summer, I stopped working at Marjorie D., where I may have mentioned that I worked. It's a children's wear and gift shop, and I worked there from the time I was 12 until I was 18, I guess. And then the summer, did I tell you about the summer that I went to Lansing, Michigan? Yes.
This was the factory that you worked in, yes.
The next summer, I worked at a realtor. And it was just on the tip of my tongue, and I forgot, but I worked in a realtor's office. And I did line drawings. I don't think they ever used them, but he was very nice, and so I was able to.
Line drawings of the houses that were for sale or buildings?
No, just for advertising for realtors. You know, I don't know.
Okay. So that you were using your art
somewhat,
skill.
Somewhat. Mm-hmm. I did the general, you know, things you do in an office mm-hmm. to help. Mm-hmm. Kim Jepsen, no. Well, can't remember. Time that I spent the next semester was the Cranbrook, and then I went to school, and then I graduated after my third summer in college. And I mentioned that before I lived in a sorority house, and when I was a sophomore, I went into the Kappa Kappa Gamma house and lived there. And made several friends there, but not ones that I really kept up with, because I didn't keep up with hardly anyone, actually, until recently. We had a friend who was also at the house then, and she sort of revived all of us. We had more time. The seniors retired, and she had sort of a loop. But I think most of us have died since we started this maybe 4 years ago, or in very poor shape. And one of my special friends in high school just has passed away. So maybe there's five of us left, you know, that I keep in touch with, because that's part of being 90. So many people aren't. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you're here in Northern California keeping up with these people you met in Michigan 70
yes.
years ago,
well, this,
right?
This is the fall. This was interesting, too, because I just met this last 2 weeks ago, I think it was, the group of people who are trying to get you to donate large sums of money, because Michigan State really offers scholarships to young people who wouldn't normally be able to go to school. And that does seem to me a very strong point, because that's what my father did through the 4-H program. And these young people would come and stay at our house, maybe 2 or 3 weeks until they got a place to live. Usually they went to a co-op, and sometimes during the Depression they only had one set of clothing that they came with. And it was always a very good thing, and so I've always been interested in community and in having the rights of everybody to have an education and to have opportunities. And now, currently, I'm interested in housing and advocacy, so that people are not given the worst building sites that are going to be flooded. So I'm sure that may be happening, because that's the sites that have been selected. But the planning department says that they're probably never used the sites. But the problem is it's worked out. So if a developer comes and says, I want to build here, there's not much you can do about it, because mm-hmm. it's tied to transportation and housing development for affordable housing. Instead of being integrated into a project, inclusionary housing is not the choice of a developer, but it should be a requirement. And this latest development on Miller Avenue, Bonderverse program, he's sneaking out of that, because he did this, began his development 6 years before they made it a requirement in Mill Valley. So the general trend is that for all opportunities, like BCDC, Bay Conservation Development Commission, they are having 9 meetings, and they had the 8th meeting trying to get into their program social equality and conservation added. And I think that started, although I forgot about all of this while I was in high school and college, and went down to New York, this was not an issue for me because I actually had a very nice place to live in New York. I went into Sage House, which was a girls' residency between 5th and 6th Avenue, and I was on off the top floor. There were 5 of us in the rooms that had been of a private home that was built in 1820, brown sandstone home on 9th Street. That had been where the servants lived. So we had a great big space, so we weren't confined in a smaller room or anything that most places would be like. And even in the sorority house, after, you know, the college experience of being a Mason, space was very nice to have, but we had straw mattresses, and no one would believe that, but we did. We literally had straw mattresses.
So I'm glad that you brought us to New York, back to New York, but could you just fill in, when you graduated from college, how was it that you ended up going to New York?
Well, the reason, I think, was because I took typing in high school. And also, in my junior year, I entered a competition through Vogue and received a 2nd place. So possibly that had something to do with it, although they never said anything. But I did write 3 letters of application when I decided I wanted to go to New York City. I'd already been offered a job through actually the home ec design department to be a interior decorator design for NS Ayres, I think is the name of it, an outstanding firm in one of the major cities in Illinois, or maybe even Indiana. But instead I wanted to go to New York City because the year before I'd gone with a friend, Mary Loring, who lived in a sorority house opposite our house, and then I'd gotten to know her because she had taken a few art classes. Well, Mary and I had gone to the Museum of Modern Art, and we also had been taken out by one of her friends. I was extraordinarily naive. I thought the Blue Plate Special was something really special, not realizing that a Blue Plate Special at Child's was probably the most economic meal that anybody could offer me.
A learning experience.
Anyway, when I went to New York, I did live at the Sage House, and although you'd think that a residency house offered by the Ladies Christian Union, they gave us teas every so often, you'd think that that would be sort of for the poor people, but it really wasn't, because the secretary to David Rockefeller lived there, and the librarian for the Cooper Union lived there, and so it was. And my roommate up on our 3rd floor was the secretary to the doctor for the mayor of New York. And Barbie had been, she was the assistant to Eisenhower, who actually was at Columbia University, had a position. So, you know, we were a varied group of people, and to be given a tea by these people, these ladies who were treating us as though they were doing us this big favor, it always made us sort of laugh. And there was one woman that would come in and raise her little big finger and say, "Cup of tea, cup of tea. May I serve you a little piece of cup of tea?" And the other thing I recall that made us laugh was that we had our woman who run the program on site. She ordered all her groceries from Christie's, which was one of the more expensive grocery stores around the corner. And towards the end of the month, we would sort of go downhill on what we were eating. But our breakfasts and our dinners were always challenging. But the thing to me was we would have orange and onion salad. And now, of course, that's not a bad thing at all. But in those days, it seemed a very strange kind of a salad to have. The great thing about New York where I worked, which was Glamour Magazine. I had applied, as I mentioned, writing three letters. The letters were to Bain Barton Osborne, an advertising firm, and to Mademoiselle and to Condé Nast. Mademoiselle was Street and Smith. And Condé Nast was the first place I went, and it was my first interview, and I had the job. So I didn't realize how difficult it really was to get a job in New York City. And I stayed in New York for 7 years and worked at Condé Nast with some outstanding people. Tina Safranska Fredericks brought in many major artists who were just beginning. She had a good eye, and she'd come from Germany. She had no accent because she said she was learning English and was told to put a hot potato in her mouth and talk with a hot potato, and she lost her accent immediately. So I don't know whether it was because she didn't want the hot potato or whether it had something to do with how you were supposed to feel when you spoke.
Can I just ask you a couple of questions? So you said that you got an interview with Mademoiselle.
No.
With Glamour.
With Glamour.
And they made the offer.
I'd written the letters of application because that seemed to be a good thing. I always told my high school students later at Glamour, I was sure I got the job because I could type, because I was the assistant to the art editor. And that enabled me to go out and meet different people. And I think I've already told you about meeting Andy Warhol and Gordon Parks and Arbus, Diane, and Alan Arbus. They were both photographers, her husband and she. And of course, they separated and she went on to become a very recognized and unique kind of a photographer. And it was a very wonderful experience. We sometimes had very short lunch periods, but that when the magazine had sort of been put to bed, then we'd have a little bit longer. So I was able to go up to the Museum of Modern Art. And I first went there with a woman called Peggy Berlin, who worked as a copy art person. We wrote very, very luxuriously. We set out the type, which was Caslon and Bodoni, which was the text. Caslon was the headlines, and we just would put down dummy type, we called it. And I helped sometimes doing the paste-ups. Very rarely I did any artwork. But the copy department had to write to copy, and so we had, Peggy was writing copy, and her husband was a well-known painter who taught at university in the Midwest. So she had extra time, and so she would take me to the museums, and so I saw my first Paul Klee. And I had, the year before, or 2 years before, Max Ernst's Celery Stalks at Midnight was something else. And I believe, in retrospect, probably ARP, the work that I saw of his, probably influenced the kind of shapes I used when I worked then at the evenings at Atelier 17, which was Stanley William Hayter's studio on 9th Street. And a great many fine printmakers and well-known artists were working there at the time, like Louise Nevelson, who later on became a sculptress. She did prints there. And, just many, many people. Fred Becker taught the summers when Hayter wasn't there, and I worked year-round every night and on the weekends. One of the things that artists generally didn't work somehow, like I had a 9 to 12 time off, and then 1 to 5 job. And then I would eat supper at Stage House, and that was on 9th Street, and actually Atelier 17 was on 8th Street. I misspoke. So it was just a short walk, two-block walk. Another short walk that was to the New School of Social Research was on 12th Street. And the old Whitney used to be just a block away. So I really It's giving weight of the time that I'm 91 almost years old. I want to go back and see the new Whitney Museum because apparently it's just something else. And it was a really surprise for them when I walked in with an artist pass maybe 20 years ago because I had had work exhibited there. And in those days, they gave you an artist pass. So it is something that I would really, really like to do, and maybe I will if I get more mobile in my life. The last time I was able to go to the Metropolitan Museum, and the first place that I was in a juried show was the first day I was at Atelier 17. Hayter said to us, "Everybody has to bring in their work." Well, and I said, "I don't have any work." And he said, "If you don't have any work, you don't belong here." So I went home, and I had pastels, and I had a sheet of big. I took a big sheet of paper home, and from the studio, and I did a flower drawing, and brought it in and put it in the pile. It was accepted at the show, so that's the first place I exhibited in a juried show.
Do you still have that piece?
So the one in Detroit Art Institute must have been an invitational show or a group show.
That piece that you did for the show at Atelier 17, do you still have that?
No, I don't, because that I traded for a vacuum cleaner.
Uh-huh.
And Julia Bovacio, who was one of the sitcoms, or what I don't know what you really call them, but one of the...
Writers?
She was a performer, was married to Bud Ortman. And Bud Ortman used to come to the apartment, and I lived with Barbie for a while. And while I was living with Barbie, he would come and take showers because where he was staying, he didn't have showers. But after I needed a vacuum cleaner. And so he had one because he wasn't staying in a place where he needed a vacuum cleaner. So when they divorced many years later, he became a teacher at Cranbrook, actually. She apparently, in the divorce proceedings, got this drawing. And then I don't know what's happened to it. But anyway, that's... And my work I signed as Kett, K-E-T-T, which I still do. The other things that I did in New York, after the intermission, you get into the operas free. And the New York had a... Uptown YMCA, I think it was YMCA, had marvelous programs, and I would go there, and then there were concert programs where I heard Wanda Landowski play on the harpsichord at the Frick Museum on Sunday afternoons. So everything I did was really low scale because I really didn't have any extra money, and Glamour magazine was a part of Condé Nast, and that was a prestige organization, and so you didn't have a high salary rate. Also, people didn't leave. It had a very stable group of employees. And over the years, magazines like Street and Smith, they changed maybe every 2 or 3 years. But we had Alex Lieberman, was our art director. He was the art director of Vogue, but he was the art director of overseeing all of Condé Nast. Tina was our art editor, and Jerry Stutz, for an example. I think I probably told you about Andy Warhol, and Jerry Stutz was the shoe editor. And when Andy's initial drawing for a little jobs column didn't work out too well, Tina thought, oh, well, we really wanted to help him because he obviously had skills. And he was given shoe drawings, and those later became his first really intense commercial drawings. Ours were editorial, but his was his relationship with Jerry Stutz sort of started him off. And then he went on to performing arts and different kinds of things that he did. Did I tell you about his letter to me that I had written?
I don't think so.
Did I tell you about meeting and seeing his portfolio?
I Yes, but I don't know if it's in the
After
transcript.
He did the job drawings, I sent him what are called tear sheets of his work, and he written me a letter with wonderful cat drawings on it. And apparently I had saved this because I had a photostat of it, and I also had a colored reproduction of the drawing that I bought from him because it was not appropriate for a fashion portfolio. So I'm trying to, in my mind, do something with that because I made photostatic copies of this last year ago at Fort Mason, where I found they have 7 wonderful presses. I was working quite a bit of time at different school presses because I never have had a press, but I always have continued doing the copper engraving that I did at Atelier 17. Prefer that as an art media.
Maybe this is a good time to ask you, was it your work at Atelier 17 that got you into printmaking?
Yes, that's the first.
Because that's been the focus of your art
after
career.
That first day, I came back, and I don't think you thought I would, but I did. And in the evening, after working, they would go to either the White Horse or the Red Cedar, and Dylan Thomas and 2 other poets would come in at the Red Horse. And I remember Dylan Thomas was, you know, he was on his decline and he was drinking a lot. And he also was going around campuses giving readings at that time. And his wife was in kind of a precarious strait. And later on, after I left New York, I probably told you that I came to East Lansing all behind me, came by train. Must have stopped in East Lansing because my mother had had a lot of copper plates that I had just maybe 3 days ago from the basement here of my house. Came up a great big large piece of copper. So I'm going to do a large copper engraving yet. And I had purchased 12 8x10 copper engravings. So I'm going to continue doing the copper engravings that I began doing in New York. And I was often in group shows of prints. The first place that a plant was purchased from me, Alex Lieberman suggested I go to Betty Parsons, who was a dealer. And Betty Parsons looked at my work and she suggested that I go to the Museum of Modern Art. And I had not done very much work at all, probably just been maybe a year or 2 years engraving. And the museum was the first place that bought a piece of my work, the Museum of Modern Art. So I had a past. Somehow I need to pick up on my past. But it was always a great thing for me to have right handy a great, you can't believe how dingy the studio was. You know, it was a gritty, the window sills were hovering all the New York City grit. And but next door, just the year that I left, there was sort of a mecca there, and I can't think of who the outstanding artist was that was running it. But there was a lot of exciting things going on for me.
Let's take a break for a second. Now, okay, we're back.
Well, I probably forgot to tell you something about my first several days in New York City when I lived at Sage House on 9th Street. The Ladies Christian Union Girls Club was a block away from the detention center for women in New York at that time. And from college, Hopi, whose name I can't recall, wish I did, had told me because I sort of hung around with some of the writers on campus as well, and apparently I must have done a lot of poetry writing because I did several things that I have that are incorporated with wood linoleum block images. The thing he said to me was, "I want you to go and meet E.E. Cummings." So I said, "Okay." how would I do that? And he said, well, you just go into this bar, and I can't recall the name, but it was the next block beyond the women's detention center. I went in, and sure enough, there he was, E.E. Cummings, and he said, please come to my home, you know. So I walked up after I talked with him a little bit at the bar, and I went into his apartment, which was down on the lower level below the street, and it was filled with books. It was just wonderful, you know, to see all these books around, but it smelled so badly from cats that I just didn't want to have anything to do with E.E. Cummings, which was showing you how naive I was. Another thing that happened to me was a friend had given me from Michigan State the name, and I went to visit him, of New Directions, the editor of New Directions, who had grown up with her as a child. She had this older friend in high school, you know, when she was maybe in junior high school, and he'd gone on, and so she gave me his name, and so I never followed through on the relationship with New Directions. So I must have had some kind of an interest in writing poetry, and I recall going to and staying overnight at Anais Nin's home in Cambridge, but I don't recall doing anything really about that. And then there were a group of poets that I went to their meeting in a cold water flat without any electricity because they hadn't paid their electrical bill. And I was just too conventional from Michigan. I just did not want to have that kind of a lifestyle. And besides, I don't know what I know I must have been interested in poetry because I remember programs that I'd gone to at the YMCA uptown in New York. And the whole episode of writing in my life sort of disappeared. Sometime I hope to go back. I have written now, maybe 40 years ago, something that I have done all the prints for, which is from the, it's called The Book of Jay, and I have half written, and it's, there's are five books of the Bible, because when I retired, I was going to read the Bible, and I never got beyond these five books of Bible, and five chapters. And so I have this written poetry kind of thing where I had done this because at our church, which I was going to in East Lansing, had been the interdenominational. I married somebody who was Jewish, and so it seemed a reasonable thing to do was go to the Unitarian Universalist Church to raise our children, our four children. The dialogue between a minister and a writer called Friedman, who said that he had written the Pentateuch in poetry form, and it was using the format or the style of Emily Dickinson. And I really knew that was wrong, because the oral tradition would not have been in the style of Emily Dickinson. And my granddaughter was probably two, not even two, and she was memorizing works from her mother playing Celtic music. And she remembered all the words because they were in a pattern, you know, a poetic, linear pattern. So anyway, that's the only writing that I really have done since then. When I first came, though, I did do some writing, poetry writing, because I have some poems that were published in Contour, which was a literature magazine at the time, out here. So that whole phase of my life disappeared when I became a mother and a teacher, and very seldom, but once in a while, did an art or engraving. New York was a wonderful experience, and I often wish I were able to go back and see some of the places. The Metropolitan Museum was the first place that I exhibited the work that first day at Hayter's studio. The first place I purchased a work was when Betty Parsons, who'd been referred to me by my art director, Alex Lieberman, who was, you know, certainly a really recognized, first of all, he was the art director, then he was a photographer of books because he knew so many painters. Then he painted and did work himself. Reference was to Betty Parsons' gallery, and she referred me to go to the Museum of Modern Art. Museum of Modern Art suggested that I, you know, they were very interested in my work, and they bought, so that was the first print that I had purchased. Later on, I was in group shows with Atelier 17, and I had purchase awards from different museums. Like one of them was the Rockefeller Purchase Award for Sao Paulo, Brazil. And apparently, somehow I was in group shows and I never collected the work. So I have a lot of work that has been sold. And one piece was sold for $90 recently, but most works are up in the thousands, you know, approaching $1,000 now because of, anyway. So I really should do more artwork. I seemingly do not, but that was my sort of special times in New York. I was fortunate up by Riverside, between Riverside and Broadway, when I, on 107th Street, I think it was, in an apartment that had been my aunt, who had lived there, whom I didn't really ever know very much, but that was the place where I was able to be along the water and the trees, which were something that I enjoyed as well as Central Park.
That's great. This is Nancy Emerson with Ket Ziegert, resuming our interview on May 8th, 2017. Ket, do you want to finish up those days in New York?
Well, yes, the days in New York, I remembered when I first went there that I met some wonderful people. One of them was Dodo. She was a fashion drawer, and she brought in her portfolio, and she was unique and did her own kinds and styles of things. So we used her often in Glamour magazine, and actually the elongated fashion drawing illustration style that she had, her own personalized development, was later copied by many others, you know, commercially. It was, the nice thing about knowing Dodo was that she was going with a young doctor who was a resident in psychiatry at up at the Columbia Hospital. And his friend, Joe Stein, became a friend of mine, and they both, all four of us would go out to eat in the Lower East Side. And I'd never known about dairy restaurants, and I'd never known about meat restaurants and the fact that you had holiday plates. Later, I went with another young man, and they called them flesh plates, and his parents, his mother wanted to follow the traditional Jewish ways of cooking, and Alan Halpern's mother was nonplussed when they brought home ham for one of the meals, so she took out the holiday plates and used the holiday plates. The restaurants served just uniquely dairy food and then uniquely meat foods. And the Lower East Side, they were a classic with waiters with white napkins on their arms and mid-European characteristic grace. That was kind of an experience. Again, people were trying to introduce me into a more sophisticated, or even in this case, a more specific way of life. But one thing especially significant was that Joe and Joe worked at Bellevue Hospital, and on the ward they found Lead Belly, and I had Lead Belly records, and they knew I was interested in them. And because they were concerned about how close he was to death and how uncomfortable it was there in the ward, they were able to get him released and go back to his own apartment, where they looked in on him, and they took Dodo and myself to visit him. And he actually took up his guitar and played, probably the last time he did played guitar. He didn't think he could, but he did.
Wow.
And so I really enjoyed that opportunity, because he still is a favorite when I hear his songs, I get nice memories.
You had a private performance.
A private performance for the four of us. And his wife.
Wow.
So that was another way that I began New York in a special manner, from people that I had met through Glamour. And I met many. I mentioned Andy Warhol, who was then Andre Warhol. And Tina had told him, or somehow he had the idea that he wanted to show his work to Tina Fredericks, but she sent me out to review the portfolio. And I purchased a drawing from him that I didn't feel was appropriate for a fashion. And then we'd had him, first of all, at Glamour Magazine, do small illustrations for our Drops column, but that didn't work out very well. So Tina, with great insight, suggested that he do shoes. And he did some neat drawings, again, unusual, for our fashion editor, Jerry Stutz, and for the magazine. And he wrote me a letter thanking me for the tear sheets, which is what we call the sample sheets from the magazine. And I have that letter copied. But unfortunately, when I needed money once again for, I sold my Kathy Kollowitz, and I sold my drawing. And the man said, "What about the letter?" And I said, "Well, you can have that." Not just because I wanted to really sort of get rid of him, but, you know, I didn't really want to, wasn't anything significant to me then. You know, I was busy being a young mother and a new teacher. And so I fortunately had made copies of those. So I do have those, and we'll do something with them at one point. Okay. Other people that I met was someone called Howard Lowe, and I did have an exhibit of prints with Howard Lowe's drawings and mine, as well as other exhibits and galleries. And I had acquisitions of prints in shows that I, from shows, in museums, apparently traveling shows around the country as well. And I do know I had some purchase awards. I'm not sure if I told you about David Rockefeller's purchase award, but that was one that was significantly important to me. And at Smith College, they had another purchase award, as I remember. And when I visited Smith College later on, because with one of my friends, I think perhaps the time my daughter was maybe interested in going to schools, I looked in their catalog, and they had my prints in their catalog.
What was that like to be to win these awards and to be?
Well, it was nothing, because I was busy doing my job and then doing work, new work. And the thing about prints, you make additions, and I was optimistic. Now, for example, I have a print here that I've had hanging up. I didn't realize, but I probably have I probably wrote 1 out of 50. And I probably have 8 images. Some images, I only have 3 or 4, and there's only one left that are printed. But these are the ones of value, except I'm still living. So as long as I'm still living, I can have more prints done, because I've saved the plates, and they're not canceled yet. So when I die, they'll be canceled, or, you know, or if nothing authorized in some way, you know, to have more prints made. The interesting thing about choosing to go to San Francisco area was I didn't know where I would live. So
Let's stop for a second. Let's back up. So you met the man who would become your husband.
By going through his portfolio. And actually, he had more interesting photographs than some of the other major people. However, he never did become a fashion photograph person. He had accounts here in San Francisco. He had worked for Fred Zinnemann on a film called Teresa in Italy, and had some very significant pictures there. He'd grown up in Chicago. And after the Warriors had gone to school at under this new school of art, not the Chicago Art Institute, but Chicago, I think, School of Design, perhaps, was called. But Man Ray and Mahaly Naj from the Bauhaus were instructors there. He was just very good at what you say would have a good eye. And when he came out here, he went to the California Institute of Arts and also finished off, I guess, a degree there.
So he was at that time then from San Francisco and happened to be in New York, and you met him.
No.
Okay.
He was born and from Chicago.
Right.
Had worked in the Hollywood area, then had gone with Fred Zinnemann, a director of films, to do special publicity work, and became a good personal friend of his in Italy on this film, Teresa. And I think at that point he was transitioning back and had thought he might like to do work for Condé Nast. So that's when I saw him.
I see.
Because actually they took more photographs of his work than of Avedon, who is a very well-known architect, a photography artist. Mm-hmm. And Bruce, who worked in our department, later became a close friend of Avedon's. But so there was an intertwining mm-hmm. of events. I did, though, have other interesting relationships with young men, but just three, and I wasn't really interested in just going to all kinds of special fancy things. I was more interested in doing my work and being employed and seeing everything, because there was so much to see in New York. In any spare time, I went with people that would want to go to art uh-huh. things and to go up to the Metropolitan Museum, or to go and hear Randall Landowski. And on my lunch times, the extended lunch times, I would go to Pierpont Museum, Pierpont Morgan Library, which always had an interesting show, still does. Gathering all my things from my aunt's apartment, leaving the furniture that was tied off, I had to leave my tables. I kept two chairs from the dining room chairs, two Eames chairs. I took them on the train with other, basic things. Left my copper plates, stopped in Michigan, left my copper plates, and prints apparently that I had at my mother's house in East Lansing, Michigan, 323 Marshall Street, and then went on, and no place planned to go, but I was shown the neighborhood around where Phoenix Studio, where my husband Don Smith and Topper, where they were, the studio 802 Montgomery Street was. I worked 20 hours a week at 802 Montgomery Street, went to school, and the second semester I was on a fellowship from the university, but went to school, and instead of taking the key train that I was told would be off a strike very shortly, it went on for years, and so, not years, but at least a year, and so I found a place at 1201 Green Street by looking. In those days, there were enough places that you could have rent-only signs, and you'd go around the neighborhood you liked, and then you'd find a building that had an available place. And ours was a nice building. It had, you walked in, and there was a place to sit down, a little lobby. We were on the second floor over a laundry, and the block up to Union Street where they had an ice cream cone place. I'd get on the bus, take the bus down to the Embarcadero, get on a ferry that went to Emeryville. Then at Emeryville, I'd get onto the Amtrak train, and I'd get the Amtrak train to Berkeley. At Berkeley, I'd get off, and I'd walk all the way up with a painting, oil, fresh oil sometimes, but an oil painting for my classes. And I had to 5 different classes at the University of California. Outstanding people. Hans Hoffman had been there before, and so the whole New York school was transitioned in a way to new young people that were in our classes, like Paul Wallner, and not Diebenkorn, but most all the other painters of that era of the San Francisco, California, West Coast, were going to school or familiarly involved there. In San Francisco then, I lived at 1201 Green Street, completed my master's in painting, and took a few courses because I kept remembering my father had always said, you should become a teacher, and I said I didn't want to. I had a few teacher courses in Michigan State, so I took enough others to get a degree, a general secondary teaching credential, which I had at the end of a year and a half. And I remember that the test was given in a school classroom, and I was so pregnant with my first child that I could barely fit into these desks, which were the old-fashioned kind of desks.
Do you remember what year that was?
I don't remember what...
What year?
What year this was? Well, this would have been 19, probably. The spring of 1955, because Ben was born early. He was born... I actually almost had a miscarriage and got off by then the key train was working, got off the train and at a funny hotel, but went into the lobby and lay down until I felt better, you know, and was able to get back on. And I didn't, but Ben did come in early. He came and the reason he came down is because the poor conditions of the road. We went down to meet his father for the first time. And on the highway along the bayshore to the airport, and it was all bump, 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 bump. We were on the elevator, and Harold had gone to get the luggage, and his father and I were standing in the elevator, and my waters broke. And he was so sweet, and he apparently knew just exactly what to do. And the next thing I knew, I was in the hospital in the admitting room, and I heard the young resident, maybe or young doctor, say, "Hell, it's a breach." And the next thing I knew after that was that I had a little baby boy. And I was so amazed. That was my first son, Benjamin. Arne, named Arne after my father. Then I had, my next child was Kathleen Ann. Benjamin projectile vomited all the time. So they thought he had a problem because he was a preemie. And Kathleen then was always sick. And so I was going down from 1201 Green Street. We had moved. At that point, friends had said, "You're going to have too big a family." So they told me about a wonderfully floor-through apartment over the Broadway tunnel, and there were the floor above us was the landlady and her husband, who amassed a lot of money as a butcher during the war years. And then our floor, and then because it was a steep hill, there was a large apartment where the woman who was the first president of the Chinese Bank of America lived. And they played mahjong, all this noise, all day long and all night long, it seemed. But that was, and our playground was the Nob Hill Playground. And then I had a third child there named Jonathan Morris. And when I came to San Francisco, we had no idea that we'd want to move and leave because it was such a nice location in life. And Harold used to go down to the bookstore that was so famous at right nearby, walk down, and to keep a steady income, which we needed because you get large contracts with advertising, but the photographs, they would come in spurts. So I decided to get a night job, and I worked at night at the Bank of America in the check proofing. We had huge computers, about twice the size of a large refrigerator, and sorted out the different accounts. And there was something called the Chow Chili Sort. And many, many years later, I found there was a Chow Chili off of Highway 5 when they put Highway 5 through.
Named after the Chow Chili town.
Yes.
Interesting.
But, so
that's
my
three
days
children.
Were very busy there. And I didn't do any painting after my year of painting. But apparently, I was in two different exhibits at the Legion of Honor paintings of mine that I had done during the year. And I have still quite a many of them I traded for things. Mm-hmm. Like we traded with the warden at San Quentin's mother's father had made handcrafted wooden furniture, and we traded for a little side table, a bureau, and a very large bookcase. And then I had the things that table that we didn't have, we went down to the antique stores along Market Street, and I saw a table upside down that had wonderful legs. So I said, well, let's get that because, you know, it was just discouraging. But this table was a wonderfully square oak table, and now we use that up at the cottage, but we had that here. And we had to get rid of all of our nice rugs that I'd purchased at the store
at Gumps?
Gumps. And I had to get rid of those because of my children's allergies. Well, it turned out that Ben's problem was allergies. Kathy was extraordinarily allergic, but basically she was an infant diabetic. And the only way, they could not figure out what was wrong with her. And I was reading because I was pregnant again with John, my third son, and a woman was going to come to take care of the other children while I was in the hospital. And I was trying to tell her that I'd been told that the children should have fruit juices, not sugar drinks. But in any event, she didn't understand, and she gave sugar drinks. And when I got home, Kathy's BMs were very small, like little rabbit. And I told that to the doctor because I'd read that as a symptom in this general book that they gave to new mothers. And I said, I think my daughter's a diabetic. And it turned out that she'd been an infant diabetic, and that was the problem. Well, then John turned out to have allergies, food allergies to milk. So we had soybean milk, Sobe. And then when Jamin came along, he just started that. We never did ever have any milk from him.
So Jamin is your fourth child.
My fourth child that I had in Mill Valley. And we moved to Mill Valley after deciding with three children right over the school, the Chinese school, that by walking down the hill down for the Broadway tunnels level, that would be their school, and we didn't want them to be around having, you know, two languages. Chinese, they'd get very confused, these little kids. And so Benjamin was probably four, and we moved out to Mill Valley. And this house, I wanted, because I didn't drive then, and I wanted to have a place where I could go into, because I was going to the UC hospital maybe two or three times a week. one of the small children's pleasure was a mark around the square dining room table saying, "Pager Dr. Peter Cohen, paging Dr. Peter Cohen, paging Dr. Peter Cohen." And what they did was let us go the very first patients so that we wouldn't have to wait all day long because I'd have these three little kids.
Now, but
I
have to say,
my husband had our cars because he needed them for business.
Right.
We had some splendid cars. The first car we had was a wood paneled station wagon. This second one was a Volkswagen Bug, and there weren't any, hardly any then, and you'd honk the horn and wave at someone if you saw someone with one. But then because the family was growing, then we got a Borgward, and no one seems to know what a Borgward was, but it was a German car that was in design was a prototype of the Hondas and the Toyotas and all the ones that are still going around. But that was our final car. When we separated, what, Harold took the car and I took the deed to the house. And I don't think that was finalized till years later when we were divorced, but that was informally how we handled things. And I didn't drive until 4 weeks after my fourth child, Jamin, was born. I took courses at Tamil Pious High School where I was going to be teaching later, it turned out. And the person that I learned from was also born in Ishpeming, Michigan. No, born in Nagaunee, Ishpeming, which is a place that my father would take us to on February 22nd, where they had the first ski tournaments, ski jumping tournaments. And so there's always a coincidence some way or another. And Nagaunee meant hell, and Ishpeming meant heaven in the native language of that area. In San Francisco, my route was always by cable car, and then the Enjuta train. Somehow we'd get to the Enjuta train to get off at Parnassus, where the University of California Hospital was then. My children were born there, and then they were all there. But Jamin was the last child. When he was born, I looked at his feet, and I said, "Oh, there's something wrong with his feet." And of course there was. So he had a bar and casts, and he got so maneuverable that he could climb out of his crib and then walk around.
And so you're saying these bars connected his feet to help?
His feet and casts.
I see, to help turn his feet a certain way?
Yes, it's the growth pattern, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, one time at the hospital, he started crying when the man was sawing the cast. I said, "You're cutting my child." He said, "Lady," I said, "my child does not cry. You are injuring my child. You stop right now." And he, resident, was upset, but I was insistent. And he, in fact, had just begun to cut into my child. If he'd gone any further, he would have cut tendons. So at that point, they decided that maybe I should have a doctor in Mill Valley. So they referred me to Dr. T.G. Brown, who charged me the same low, low rate of the clinic in the hospital. And Dr. T.G. Brown was just a dream and a wonderful person. And my children had a spell when they would be always sick and they would get strep. And so she would call up and say, "Bring them down before school. We'll get the blood test, and then after school, we'll call us and we'll see if we need to give them shots." And if neither coxsackie virus or it was strep. We had just a long, maybe a year or so cycle, and finally we found out why they were getting strep all the time. And it was because our backdoor neighbor with whom the kids all played, we had the Highland Hill kids and the Rising Road kids. And I could stand on the back deck and see the kids and call them in, you know, because this is, they played together They threw apples at each other in warfare. They did all kinds of things. But the Blackner kids had Kaiser, and Kaiser only gave pills. They didn't give inoculations when you had strep, and they were carriers of the strep. And so we finally found out why, and our doctor got them to give their children shots so then they could not be carriers. So that ended happily. But that went on for far too long. But that was how obliging Dr. office was. And so always put herself out. When my son Benjamin graduated, she offered to let him buy her car at a reasonable rate, her Volkswagen that had a window. And in that window, he put the rocking chair you see over there that protrudes. So he drove from Arizona with that rocking chair through the roof all the way back here. And Ben has loved to drive. And I think probably it's because I like to drive, having just learned to drive so very late, when I was probably 33 maybe. And then with my children, twice we went across Canada and returned through the States, across the country. And the first time we went, my good neighbor that lived on Rising Road, whose husband also taught in the art department. And after the 1 year in teaching in Whittier, my friend up here had moved down to that area, and he had a family of maybe 4 or 5 children and had lived in San Anselmo. And he went out and looked for a place for me to live, and he found one that was similar to the Eckler home in design. And it was on a cul-de-sac, and at the other end of the cul-de-sac, about a block and a half away, was an elementary school. And so Benjamin went into first grade, and Kathy was in kindergarten. And it was at a fenced yard, and it was an ideal place to live, and I taught school. And unfortunately, I had 5 different preparations because I was, you know, a new teacher. It was a brand new school. The first month or so, I was teaching ceramics in a room that didn't have any water connection yet, so I had to use a hose outside. And then I had to mop the floor afterwards. And perhaps the first week, we had no real supplies, and there was this huge box that somebody brought in of leather scraps. Well, you know, what are you going to do in a crafts class with leather scraps? Well, you certainly are not going to do with a mess. So I had all the students sort them, and we had these empty boxes sort of for their storage areas. So the kids, just in this particular class, just started throwing all these colors into the boxes across the room. It was working just fine. But, you know, it was very, you know, everything was happening all which way. And the principal came in to pull one of the kids out of the class for some other prior problem. And the kid said, you know, this is a stupid class. You know, all they're doing now is throwing stuff. I don't mind leaving, you know, in conversation. So the principal came back with the kid, and the class was completely in order. All the places were sorted, all of, and the kids were, you know, happy. We behaved, and the class was going to end. And he looked around the room, and then he looked at the kid, and he didn't believe the kid. You know, he thought the kid was lying to him, but he wasn't. I said, no. I said, we were sorting leather. And he said, well, I have to tell you something when this class ends. So the class ended, and the kids left. He said, this class you have is composed of the worst kids in all the school districts of the Los Angeles district. We broke up their gangs. And so you have the worst gang kids in this. And you never, never want to have confusion in your class. You always want to be at the back. You keep them in a circle. and you always walk around the circle so that you always can keep your eye on them. I mean, things that were just completely contrary to the way that I believed in teaching. And then it turned out that so the person who was the art department had sorted out all the classes, so I had the classes of the least able people and he had the ones that were supposed to be so special. And the great shocker to him was that I had these kids that weren't supposed to be so special, and we did some rendering of picture and fruit, still life. And I taught them how to use a improvised edge and to push the color, to blend the colors. So they had a chiaroscuro rounding traditional appearance for the fruit and for the still life objects. And I put the drawings from everybody in the class up, and that's always been my philosophy. You don't just take the very special things, but always, you know, have everyone's work exhibited. I was pleased to see last year at the art show of Tamalpais High School students, some just really, I think something was lacking in the teaching, but there were, every single student's work was up. So that really, really pleased me, because that's the philosophy that I had developed. My teacher training courses, I taught at Claremont Junior High School, in the English program for my minor, and I taught at Oakland Tech from a very excellent teacher for my arts program. I never had to do a lesson plan or anything for the art teacher, but for the junior high school English teacher, I had to write out a lesson plan, I had to say what I was going to ask, and I had to write down the replies that the students were going to give me from the questions that I asked. And it was a completely controlled, entirely different approach. And I managed pretty well in both of them.
Good training.
And the students at this middle school, when you know I was beginning to, almost more than beginning, it was the fall semester, and Benjamin was to be born in April. So they gave me a shower, and they said, you know, you are the best teacher we ever had. And the one thing I did that I really enjoyed was, for an example, I discussed Robin Hood, and I had not known much about Robin Hood. So I had a strong background after all my reading for this program about the life of Robin Hood, and he actually was a person. I hadn't realized that. But I was prepared to teach well, and the three schools that we were recommending to try to achieve if we were going to be going into teaching, and I wasn't going to be a teacher at that point, were Tamalpais Union High School, the East Whittier High School, and the Claremont High School system. And Tamalpais High School was considered statewide one of the three best schools. So I was pleased to teach at two of those. And when I came to Tamalpais High School, I think the unique thing about Tamalpais High School was that we had a very collegial group of teachers, and we had a principal who had a good, very good open philosophy, Prather, Robert Prather, but he was not a directional leader, so the teachers could co-direct their own departments within the framework of an excellent school system. So I think that was one great thing